Greetings, friends. It's your Chapo for this week. We've got a jam-packed show for you today, filled with labor and education issues, kicking off with a great interview with a teacher currently on strike in West Virginia. So let's dive in. Okay, so joining us this week, we have a very special guest. It's Michael McCaden, who is a teacher in West Virginia, who's calling in from there right now to tell us a little bit about the amazing strike that's been going on over the past week in West Virginia. So, Michael, just to get started, just in very, very generally, like the background here, why did this strike happen? What was his initial cause, and what were your as the teachers? What was your initial ask here?
Well, the long and short of it is this: anger has been brewing for quite some time. The natural gas industry, the coal industry, has continually asked for lower and lower taxes, and our Republican-led legislature and for the longest time Democratic legislature has been more than willing to give them those lower taxes. So we've seen the effects of neoliberal capitalism in this state, the result of lower taxes, meaning fewer funds for public services. So we knew that this was coming. Probably the biggest spark to it all was this little thing in our healthcare program called Go 365. So if your listeners haven't heard what Go 365 is, I'll try to briefly summarize. Basically, it gamifies your health. So you have to check in with your smartphone or Apple Watch or something to show that you're doing some type of exercising. And so you would have to get 3,000 points one year, 5,000 the next year, so on and so forth. So for teachers who already work about 12 to 15 hours a day between lesson plans, grading, monitoring kids, second jobs, you name it, somewhere in between there, we kind of had to find time to go to the gym. And that was kind of the breaking point for a lot of teachers who felt like this was just too damn much.
Wow, so, that sounds super fun. Yep. That sounds like solutioneering.
I feel like such an asshole. I said, oh, you know, those Fitbits, they're going to make you do that. I didn't know they were actually already making people do this.
Yeah, it's a totally dystopia.
So, Mike, I mean, I had no idea about this, and I'm dumbfounded by it. It's like, as a contingent for your health care for public school teachers in West Virginia is lashing you to a Fitbit and making sure you do a certain amount of steps a day?
Yep. That's essentially what they wanted us to do.
They installed,
okay, I'm done with this interview.
They installed the wheel
we're
of pain.
We're going to West Virginia. We're bringing guns.
They installed the wheel of pain from Conan in all of the teachers' lounges.
A platinum health plan is that you have to join CrossFit.
That's already amazing, Michael. But what, like, so over the past week here, what were, like, what negotiations took place? What was the settlement that was reached earlier this week? And most importantly, why did you guys choose not to go with that settlement?
Well, we had all met with our legislators, and they pretty much told us at the beginning of the legislative session that they had plans to push through basically everything different Republican-led legislatures across the state and country, have already been doing. So we said, listen, if you guys try to attack our seniority, if you try to attack our healthcare, if you try to not increase our pay and do all these things, try to provide funding for charter schools, that's it. We just can't take it anymore. We're done with it. And so I actually was working with a close friend of mine now in Charleston by the name of Jay O'Neill. And in the beginning of the summer, last summer, we started talking about trying to gather up some friends and other fellow teachers who are equally upset by the fact that our union establishment really hadn't done anything to stop this. So we gathered together, we created this secret Facebook group. Jay took the lead on it. I tried to agitate in whatever way I could. And yeah, it started with a few dozen teachers, and then it sparked to about 20,000 public employees. And by that time, it just became too large. So the proposal that they tried to pass through earlier this week was essentially saying, look, we'll give you guys 5%, 3% for some other public employees. We won't touch your insurance plan for the next 16 months, and we'll appoint a task force to try to find revenue. But lo and behold, the Republican-led state Senate decided they keep wanting to stall on these bills. And as we speak, they still have yet to pass the pay raise bill that passed in the House by 98-1.
Yeah, I was actually reading about this. There's a lot of really good coverage about this all over the place. There's good stuff in Jacobin by Eric Blanc, but there's also one that's really excellent in Jacobin by Megan Day that's literally called It Was About the Insurance Fix. And I'm just reading briefly here. She says, according to the strikers, the 5% raise offered won't reverse the damage that rising healthcare costs have done to West Virginia public employees' ability to make ends meet. Explaining why she chose to remain on strike, one teacher said, the number one thing we needed was a permanent fix to PEIA. It wasn't about the money at all. It was about the insurance fix. That to me is so fascinating that people are completely aware at this point that these little tiny boosts in wages are just such a, you know, a bait and switch, such a like, yeah, well, we'll give you a little more in your pocket. And all the while they're making you less secure by just completely undermining what was essentially, I think, you know, the strongest selling point of a job with a public school system is that you had the security and you had these benefits because you were doing something that everyone recognized was a completely necessary public good. And one of the only things that you could still call like a decommodified right in this country, an actual free public education.
Yeah, absolutely. And the biggest problem that we as a state face is we have some of the highest healthcare costs in the nation. The amount of, if you look at the statistics, the obesity rate in the state is one of the highest. The amount of individuals who have black lung correlated to working in the mines is, one of the highest in the country as well. The amount of adults who get the required amount of vegetables and fruits every day is incredibly low in this state. So our insurance costs in this state are already high, as is. And because we lack the necessary tax revenue to continue to fund these services, and there's a monopolized healthcare market in this state, there's simply no way for the Republican legislature to feel like they had any way to continue funding this. So they just kept pushing it on to onto the employees.
Michael, so like this strike is going on right now. This is probably one of the biggest, one of the biggest labor actions that's taken place in this country in the last few decades?
Yeah.
It's getting scant coverage in the mainstream press. Amber mentioned some places that are covering it. But this is all taking place in the context of a looming Supreme Court decision in the Janus case that will, for all intents and purposes, gut public sector unions nationwide. However, what's interesting about this strike is that West Virginia is a state that is already post-Janus. Could you talk a little bit about that and what it's like how the other public sector workers are responding to this?
Yeah, and what's funny to me when I've done interviews or read articles about this, that we're living in this soon-to-be post-Janus world where public sector unions are essentially going to be gutted after the Supreme Court decision. To be honest, most of the people on the ground really haven't relayed that in their discourse. I mean, they haven't talked about the effects of Janus. They really haven't seen union bosses as being necessary in the negotiations. I mean, they're figureheads and they're people necessary for the functionings of these larger associations in the state, to be sure. But most of this started as a grassroots effort. It started with people who rallied around a common cause and found effective ways to negotiate this information digitally, try to send it as quickly as possible and to rally the troops, so to speak. And so right now in West Virginia, we're living in a right-to-work state. There's not really the same ability that the cultural unions that we've had, like the United Mine Workers Associations or the American Federations of Teachers. You know, those unions have pretty much been gutted by and large, but we use those unions, to be honest, as vehicles for further agitation. We didn't use the traditional union leadership as the model for how to go about this. We took it upon ourselves to rally teachers in each school and to disseminate this information as quickly as possible. So we didn't say, hey, go to this, you know, union meeting every month where it's an inconvenient time for you at a place you're not going to be able to get to for an hour, and you're going to just hear the same old standard, you know, union spiel. This was having sustained conversations in digital spaces with our coworkers at lunch. We found we had similar issues, and we tried to come up with to get on the same track as a state about how do we resolve these. So I think what this state has shown and what the strike has shown is if we live in a post-Janus world where public sector unions are destroyed by and large with this case, you can still fight back without needing to rely on standard business unionism. You can find this within yourselves and try to organize more, I would say, because I come from the wobbly tradition, more of along the lines of an industrial unionism.
Yeah, I mean, one of the fascinating things about this is not only is it a wildcat strike, meaning, you know, it was done without the blessing of the union leadership, but it's illegal. I mean, it's illegal for you to be striking. And there's three different unions that are taking place in this. You've got AFT, WVEA, and then the West Virginia School Service Personnel Association, correct?
Yes. And well, and let me be clear, though, because this has come up a little bit, too. There's a difference between something being illegal and something being unlawful. Technically, the strike is unlawful. What that means is there's a precedent court case from 1990, the last time teachers across the state went on strike. And there was this court case in Jefferson County, the Jefferson County Board of Education versus the Jefferson County Education Association. And there was an injunction placed on the teachers in that county demanding that they return to work. And they appealed this to, I think it was the state Supreme Court. And at the time, the attorney general also wrote a memo declaring that the strike was illegal because students in the state have a constitutional right to an education. Therefore, public employees, especially teachers, don't have a right to strike. So the current attorney general, Patrick Morsi, is not relying on any specific criminal statute that makes a strike technically illegal that they can enforce. It's simply his relying on a precedent court case and a precedent attorney general memo that's saying it's lawful to do so. But if they were to try to enforce this, which we're seeing the injunctions are coming soon, we think Ohio County, where Wheeling is in the northern panhandle, might be where the first test of this is going to take place. But if these injunctions come down, there's a good possibility that they could be challenged in court, and then they'd have to put a halt on it until the courts could sort this out. So we are really in this very tricky legal situation where we're not entirely sure what's going to happen, but we're also at a benefit because they have 700 plus teacher vacancies in the state. You know, there's no one who's actually coming into the state to teach. So we actually have an advantage because we can witness the power of being teachers in a state where they need us, where they need people to stay in the state. So really, I mean, we've been saying, bring it on.
Absolutely. It's extremely cool. And also, no one is going to scab.
No.
Going on this past week or so, what has been the reaction like from the community itself, from your kids, from their parents, from just like people at large in West Virginia? Like what has been the response like to this strike?
Oh, the community outpouring of support has been phenomenal. And one of the beautiful things about teaching in this state is this state has, for as conservative as it has as its own history, has a very longstanding community tradition of mutual aid and relatively good cultural support for unions as a whole. So when we knew that a walkout was most likely going to occur a few weeks ago, what happened was a lot of local nonprofits, churches, and schools began organizing food drives to prepare for a long haul. So, for example, I'll tell you guys that I manage one of our county's Facebook pages. And as soon as we found out that there was going to be a walkout for 2 days, you know, we didn't know it'd last this long, but we started preparing a food drive. And we just got message after message after message from parents, from community leaders, asking to donate. And we took it to a central location, bagged it all up, and sent it on to the county, who is more than happy to help. So what we've seen is the teachers who were asked to participate in this walkout have been told you have to do something every day if you can. Okay, don't treat this like a day off. So if you can make it to the picket lines, make it to the picket lines. If you can, to, you know, show that you're out there trying to push for these better bills to help educators and help kids. If you can't make it there, go to the Capitol to agitate there. And if you can't do that, work at a local nonprofit to distribute food, to donate food, show that community support. And there has been nothing if not an outpouring of support from the people that we serve who want these changes to happen, not because they think that we're greedy and not because they think that teachers are a different sector of employment necessarily, but they want the best for their kids. And they know that if we succeed, their kids will succeed. And so if it takes a week or two or three, they're willing to make that sacrifice with us and for us because they know that it'll benefit them too in the long run.
I've noticed also like the response to this from people who are your detractors, of course, always will try to make it about the children. This is the classic, the Helen Lovejoy move. Won't someone think of the children? How are the kids doing? I mean, I would imagine they're enjoying themselves not having to go to school.
You know, there have been a lot of, I mean, I've heard reports, you know, kids like having this time off because, you know, for them, it's essentially an early spring break. But we've seen a lot of students organizing their own food drives in their area. We've seen students come to picket lines to protest with their teachers. We've seen actually this weekend, I think it was on Friday, there was a student-led march at the Capitol for this strike. So students have not taken a passive role in this. And to be sure, there's going to be a lot of students who are going to use this as time off to relax and hang out with friends. But we've seen a lot of kids who actively wanted to participate in government. I mean, I don't know if you guys saw this video, but when our governor, Jim Justice, was touring the state on Monday, there was a sixth grader who spoke up and he said, look, you have a conflict of interest, Mr. Justice, because you asked for $100 million for a tourism budget and you own the Greenbrier. You will specifically benefit from this tourism budget that you specifically requested. And when he started going off on this tangent about how a dollar spent in tourism equals this much in revenue, the kid said, well, think of education as future revenue, and people will soon be smarter to vote because of this, to vote for people unlike you. And I'm kind of paraphrasing here, but I mean, he just got applause out the wazoo after saying this. So there's been a lot of active students in this state who are supporting what's happening.
We're recording this on a Saturday. I'm sure you saw, we just saw some headlines that teachers in Oklahoma were considering
statewide strike, yes,
doing their own strike. Have you heard anything about that?
I've heard there was talk in Tennessee, North Carolina, and Arizona. I hadn't seen anything about Oklahoma, but if you say so, that's empowering.
I mean, it's pretty incredible the knock-on effect that this is happening. This is having not just with teachers, but like I said, the more this is covered, I think it's very impressive, and I think it can't help but have an effect on the national imagination, just in terms of what is possible if we are going to be a right-to-work country, that like perhaps this is a model going forward.
Yeah, I mean, I hope that what we're doing here in the state actually resonates with people all across the country, and we've had an outpouring of support from people. I saw the strikers, I think, I can't remember what university it was, but in the UK were coming out in support of us. We've had people from Canada who are donating to funds and wanting to come down to the Capitol and learn about what's happening. So we're hoping that what we're doing right now will inspire future strikes across the country. And we realize the eyes of the world are watching us. So we know that if we win, they win. So we can't back down. We can't compromise because this could affect everyone.
Like I said, this is a Saturday. This was originally planned to be a 2-day strike. What does it look like going into Monday and next week for you?
Well, last I checked in the Senate, they had to convene a special session today because of everything that's been happening. The last I checked, the Senate voted to table the House bill for a teacher pay raise yet again for the third day in a row. They sent it along to the Senate Finance Committee. And the Senate Finance Committee chairman has been pretty uncommittal to this whole thing. He does not want to see it go through. So he's doing his own stall tactics. And actually, as we speak, I think they're considering the House bill to look at what the revenue is going to be like. But the biggest issue right now, as we're talking, is they need to find a source of revenue, and they will not have a long-term source of revenue to fix PEIA, to have teacher pay raises, unless they raise a severance tax on natural gas. And right before this strike happened, I don't know if you guys saw, but one of the people who's running for House of Delegates, Alyssa Lucas, this made national news. She was simply reading off a list of donations that members of the legislature received, and they cut off her mic. They escorted her out. They were furious at the fact that she had the gall to announce public information about how much money these delegates were receiving. They said, listen, just stick to the issue. Don't go on this tangent. Just speak to the bill. And she's saying, listen, if I'm saying what these gas companies are paying the legislators to vote for, then that does relate to the bill. And so we've seen the fact that this state is so corrupt and so in the back pocket of these industries, whether they're Democrat, whether they're Republican, that the only way to change it is through direct action. That's what we're seeing right now. And so unless the Senate Finance Committee says you can fund these new proposals with a long-term severance tax on the natural gas industry, which we don't think is possible, this strike could very well continue into next week. And there's talk of occupying the Capitol. They voted on Friday to occupy the Capitol. They decided against it because they needed to strategize. So if things go south this weekend, you could see essentially what happened in Wisconsin in 2011 take place here in West Virginia in 2018. But the amount of public support we have right now and the push beyond electoral politics might show what Wisconsin could have been had they focused solely on that direct action instead of just turning it into a recall vote.
Well, yeah, but I mean, Joanne Reed pointed out today that the real lesson for this is that you people need to start voting for people who have all of your best interests in heart, i.e. Democrats. So what's your problem? Why aren't you getting on board?
Yeah, why are you not getting out the vote right now?
Why didn't you vote for a Democratic governor last year?
I know. Stupid mistake.
Well, I mean, it is kind of exciting that we're seeing a turn toward what Adolf Fried and Mark Dudzik called social unionism, where you're getting away from the strong electoral focus, and you're doing these rank and file actions and focusing specifically on things like public goods, things like public education. And it is really shocking to me. I looked it up, and I guess despite being 48th in salaries nationally, West Virginia teachers have a like 98% high school graduation rate. That's insane that they're that successful under those conditions.
Yeah, I actually didn't know it was that high. And I do have the one caveat for that, however, and I don't mean to be a Debbie Downer with this, but if you look at a map of West Virginia, the southern counties are the ones that are traditional coal countries. That's the area where the mine wars took place in the early 20th century. And in those parts of the state, that's where it's been hit hardest with the economic downward turn of the last few decades, with the decline of coal, with the decline of good paying union jobs, things like that. I think McDowell County in the southern part of the state is the poorest county in the country. And in that county in particular, they have, I think, something like 60% of their high school graduates who go on to post-secondary education, college, trade schools, things like that. They have to take remedial classes because they haven't been prepared as well. So one of the things the legislature is trying to do is to lower the graduation requirements to make it easier to graduate. So what they're essentially doing is trying to widen the door, make the numbers look like people are doing a lot better than they actually are. And that's no fault really of the teachers themselves, because we work with the conditions that we have, and we know how the local economic situations mirror what the graduation requirements could be or should be and what the students are capable of. So we realize we have to take a holistic approach, but at the same time, they're simply not trying to help those communities become self-sustaining. So we're unfortunately seeing this increase in people who do graduate from high school who unfortunately just they're simply not prepared for the world after graduation. They just, their schools want good numbers, and so they'll do what they can to pass them through.
Mm-hmm. Michael, just to wrap things up here, again, going into Monday, what in your mind would be a satisfactory conclusion to this? What would victory look like for you in this strike?
I would say Workers' Republic, but that's probably far reaching. If I'm being honest, the thing that would probably make us most happy is a natural gas severance tax that can at least show some type of revenue for the public employees insurance plan and the 5% pay. If we can get those two things, we'll go back to work. Because everything else has pretty much been resolved. It's these last two issues and their economic issues that are affecting us most. So if we can get those two things, I think we're good. We'll probably head back to work next week if they pass it over the weekend. The likelihood, though, that that'll happen is probably slim to none. I think the Senate is probably going to drag their feet. Maybe as we're talking, things have changed rapidly. I doubt it. But I would say those are the two biggest issues that we need in order to return to work.
Michael McCadden, teacher in West Virginia, on strike right now, speaking on behalf of myself and I'm surely all our listeners, we are 100% rooting for you guys in West Virginia now, and I think the rest of the country should be paying a lot more attention to this. And if they would, I would just stress to also send support. If people if people want to support you guys in any way, is there any fund that they can donate to or anything that they can do if they're not in West Virginia?
Yeah, I will send you guys links to some of the sites we have up. We have a strike fund with GoFundMe to help teachers if there's issues and they need additional pay should that it come to that. We also have a strike fund or a solidarity fund with the West Virginia branch of the IWW. And we have a little over $3,000 with that last time I checked. So I'll send you guys the links and, you know, feel free to donate whatever you can, time, money, even just a few pictures to help us with our morales, funny memes, you name it. We're always looking for something.
Oh, boy. Everybody listening, just their bow ties started spinning at the prospect of doing memes.
I'll send some pictures of my cats along. Michael, once again, thanks for everything you're doing, and thanks for taking a little bit of time to talk to us this afternoon.
Absolutely. Solidarity from West Virginia.
Thank you. Solidarity.
Thank you. I wanted to begin by talking a little bit about, the interview we just did with, nothing but support for those teachers in West Virginia.
It rules, and it's so rare we get to talk about actual politics on this show instead of just dunking on media people.
Well, I mean, the media people have been mostly ignoring. I mean, it hasn't been getting really the full bore coverage.
Yeah. I mean, we will definitely dunk on them. I'm just saying, like, how often do we get to be like, oh, something really exciting and eventful is happening?
Yeah, absolutely. Just like more broadly, though, Matt, speaking of dunking on media people, Matt did reference the Joanne Reed tweet today about this, which is, I can't imagine a more condescending attitude to have.
Deep scorcher.
It's certainly one that's indicative of, you know, her and anyone who takes her seriously, is that like the problem here is that we just haven't elected enough Democrats.
Right. The problem is you rubes don't vote for people who support higher teacher pay. But I looked up Jim Justice, who's the governor of West Virginia. I looked up his old campaign website. He was elected as a Democrat. He flipped from Republican to Democrat. And
Democrat
decided,
to Republican?
Oh, no. First he flipped.
He was a Republican. Switched to Democrat to run for governor. Then switched to Democrat Republican after he won.
Fucking mask off.
These hoes ain't loyal.
Here's not all his issues, Paige. Pay our teachers what they're worth. As governor, Jim will make West Virginia an education powerhouse so we can attract the best teachers. He believes that we must pay our teachers what they're worth, and he's doing it, and that education is the key to repairing the image of our state and attracting new jobs here. Both the West Virginia Education Association and the AFT have endorsed Jim Justice for governor. And 7 months into his term, he flipped to Republican.
Wah, wah.
And also, the only about 20% of the teachers union went for Trump. So even like, okay, so you increase that margin by like, you make it so that it's 90% of the teachers went for Trump or Hillary. They're still, Trump wins that state handily.
Fun fact, Jim Justice is West Virginia's only billionaire.
And he should be the governor.
Richest man in the state.
The Monty Burton style.
He also allegedly owes like literally millions to the state in back taxes.
That's,
so
that's how you do it.
He personally just.
He's smart. Folks, he's very smart.
And the Democrats were the vehicle to let the richest man become governor.
And beyond that, this just shows how presentist these people have the fucking memory of beagles. Until 2000, West Virginia was probably the most reliably Democratic state in the Union.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It elected, it almost always voted for the Democrat in the presidential race, and they didn't elect a Republican senator until the 21st century. That is how Democratic it was. And it was under those Democrats that West Virginia slid into the post-industrial shithole it's in now. What the fuck experience with Democrats would tell a person in West Virginia that they're the vehicle for their aspirations?
Yeah, and I mean, it's not like it's not totally lost. Like, I don't know how many of you guys have been following the steel tariff thing.
Yeah.
And it's kind of funny because it's Trump is pissing everybody off by trying to unilaterally raise steel tariffs to bolster America's steel industry, which it is impossible to get those jobs. You're just not going to get those back. You know, half the world's steel production is in China now. The moment that like Asia caught up industrially, there was no chance for us to have the same market share. But it's like,
I mean, I don't think that's true.
Why?
I think that we can do manufacturing in the U.S. I think it's entirely possible.
I don't think we'll capture back enough of the market shares to bring those jobs back through steel manufacturing.
First of all, we already do have manufacturing in the U.S. The thing is,
with steel though,
no, but we do have manufacturing in the U.S. The thing is, the way stuff gets allocated because of like the global economy. Yes, the big things like steel have outsourced to China. And I literally watched that happen in Indiana. But like these things are not like God's law. Like you can put a steel plant in the middle. Actually, it's still a steel plant that I grew up in the shadow of in Pittsburgh, Indiana. And it's right there. And all the stuff is there. And you drive by it. And it's like this weird, terrifying, like dead coral reef in the middle of like an agrarian setting, just like haunting the entire town. But you could theoretically, again, it would require state planning.
It would require high tariffs.
It would require higher tariffs than Trump is willing to do. And it would require like a level of central planning that he won't do. My point is that like all the things that appeal to voters in West Virginia from like the sort of Trump faux populism, they're not going to pan out. And there would be an opportunity for Democrats to actually seize the moment. But this thing of like, well, you know, if only they voted for Democrats, you know, as Will pointed out, and Virgil pointed out, it's completely revisionist. It's not like they've just been lost since the Southern strategy. And B, like they're not, there is no also hard law that they're going to be totally entranced by this Trump ploy that isn't really going to do anything for them.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The thing that's interesting to me about, you know, where the Democrats play in all this is, you know, Arnie Duncan and Michelle Rhee are Democrats in good standing. Teachers unions have become, you know, villains largely to the Democratic Party. And a lot of liberals have bought that line. And I think what's going on here is that the Democratic Party is now largely the party of the meritocratic professional class. And I think in the certain mentality, I don't think they regard teachers as part of the professional class. I think they think that teachers don't belong in the professional class because they think they don't work hard enough or their skills aren't specialized.
Well, I think if they don't work in the private sector.
Well, yeah, and like I do think that there's something like Barbara Ehrenreich has this term that we throw around a lot, and I don't know if we've ever actually translated on the show, but professional managerial class.
Mm-hmm.
And the Democratic Party is the party of the PMC. Now, that is not the same thing as class in a Marxist sense where it's like you're working for wage, because that includes a huge number of people. However, like it is a real social designation, and it is an amazing indicator of like reactionary anti-worker tendencies against people who would otherwise consider themselves at the very least, leftish liberal.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, and a big part of the PMC, I think, at least as it relates to the attitudes towards teachers, is largely in the liberal media class, which is doubly funny because they regard what they do as some kind of special skill.
Oh, totally.
Whereas being a teacher isn't.
Yeah.
Right. Like, fair enough. If you're a fucking heart surgeon or whatever. Yeah. Okay. You've got a pretty special set of skills there. It took a long time to get. But come on, being a teacher is way more of a special skill than writing for a fucking newspaper.
Yeah. I mean, you know how? Because I'm not doing it because I'm too lazy.
Yeah.
Like,
But no, I think a lot of it, the hostility, especially to teachers and teachers unions, comes from a kind of policing the boundaries of a sort of class association as it regards to sort of elite liberals who don't regard teachers as really in their club.
Absolutely. And it's weird. It's, again, back to Barbara Ehrenreich. There's this... And she wrote this a long time ago, but there's a book called Fear of Falling that discusses the kind of anxiety of sort of formerly middle class, you know, maybe Democrat voting PMC people. And that has only increased. So now people are trying to make their kids like hyper fucking competitive to be able to compete on the market because it's become even more cutthroat than it was when she wrote this book. And, you know, who gets the blame when, you know, little, I don't know, what's the
Cody,
little Dylan. Cody,
yeah. They're all named Taylor now, yeah. Boys and girls.
When little Madison doesn't, get a perfect SAT score because they're like, you're the reason my beautiful, perfect angel, my beautiful round boy is not getting into an Ivy League. And if they don't get into an Ivy League, they're not going to be successful. And then they're going to end up like you, like a fucking teacher.
Well, yeah, that's true. They really do. They put a lot of, it really is, they put the pressure on the kids and then they put the blame on the teachers. And this deep hostility to teachers unions, it's like, you're standing in the way. We need to.
It's fear of falling.
You need to discipline our kids to get better. And the way you do that is by us disciplining you with the market, putting the gun at the fucking boot of the market against your neck to make you perform as well as possible. Because we know that's the only way that people work well anymore is with precarity and with a threat at the back of their neck. That's the only way people get the most out of
people. And a little bit of technocracy thrown in.
And these teachers with unions, the only people left with unions protecting them from the market's discipline, are going to fuck up turning your kid into a MacArthur Genius Grant winner.
Talk about discipline. I mean, the thing that I'm, again, still dumbfounded from this interview was the shit about required exercise and Fitbits.
I thought that was
10
a few years
high,
ago.
Yeah, yes.
Well, I mean, what?
I thought that was a few years from now. I'm sorry.
What have we been saying about daycare world? They're literally making you do gym class on your own now. And I think it's interesting that, in the past 3 or 4 years, the sort of professional managerial classes started like co-opt a lot of Black Lives Matter stuff, but you only see them try to break the back of one union, and it's the teachers union, never the cops union, the only other union that protects people besides maybe SAG or all that shit, the Brian Singer pool party union. But it is very,
that's the DGA, by the way.
the pool party planners union. But it is very interesting, the union that they seek to break the back of in the municipal government.
Our teachers, and I think it's because, a lot of these liberal snots, I think they don't like them because they think being a teacher is an easy job.
And they
think they're paid too much.
Women do it.
Mm-hmm.
And also, again,
you get summer vacation. Yeah, you get paid summer vacation.
Yeah. No, and one of the things actually that does kind of chap my ass about this is that people are forced, and I think well-meaning people do feel compelled to use that line, which is not untrue. Teachers' working conditions are students' learning conditions. And that is absolutely true. But also, Jesus fucking Christ, you shouldn't have to be like, it's for the children. Teachers deserve good working conditions. Fuck the kids is what I'm saying. Fuck them.
Oh, someone joined WGA.
And again,
like, shop steward.
Overall, like, what
Amber is a moderator at Our Child Free.
These goddamn crotch fruit in the school, filling our schools with my tax dollars.
Every school should have a Harry Potter costume contest, and adults should always win because they care more.
While I'm on this tear, as someone who actually secretly does love children. I think what the PMC kind of parenting technique has produced is what people write off as kind of a right-wing fantasy, this like helicopter fantasy, mm-hmm. like parenting thing. It's not a fantasy. These people are insane. Like they're absolutely, I mean, it's not just that they're hovering, it's that they're trying to make their kids lean and competitive for the market. And that automatically produces this kind of weird psychosis, and rich people watch their kids way too fucking much. It is insane the amount of focus they exact on these children who become these neurotic fucking messes.
Yeah. It's not exactly a way to build self-confidence and independence in a kid is to like pretend that literally homework in third grade fucking matters at all. Like, come on. It's just
on your permanent record. Those smiley faces and frowny faces are on your permanent record.
There was a math test to get into a more advanced math class when I was like, I think in like fifth grade. And they were like, listen, this isn't a big deal. You should know these problems. But if you don't get these right, you're not going to get in the advanced math class, which means that in high school, you won't get into AP, which means colleges are less likely to.
Yes.
And it's like, we're 10.
Do you guys remember Bowling for Columbine?
Now I work at a podcast. Fuck you.
Do you guys remember Bowling for Columbine?
Yeah, it's exact same thing. Yeah. Exact same thing.
They interviewed one of the South Park men. I don't know.
Matt or Trey.
Yeah, Matt or Trey.
Cartman.
They interviewed Cartman. And one of the things he did bring up, because he was from the area, one of the things he did bring up was that, you know, you have such an insane amount of anxiety, and this is a relatively recent thing, too. You have such an insane amount of anxiety put on you as, you know, whatever, a upwardly mobile, you know, middle class kid to maintain your class status that you're like, well, if you don't get into AP math, then you're not going to get into AP classes in high school. And then you're not going to get into a good college. And then you're not going to, then you're going to live in a dumpster. Then you're going to be a teacher. You know, which you know is an undignified thing, and you should definitely not become a teacher because it's a sinkhole, and you should become the people that are crushing them. It's absolutely, it betrays a kind of like we've completely given up on the idea of childhood.
Yeah.
Right now.
Yeah,
I can't wait till the way that I helicopter parent my kids with my path, and I'm like, look, if you don't like fuck around posting on the internet starting at age 10 and develop like just sort of figure out like the best way to develop your ironic voice, don't go to school for like a year and a half or two, then just start posting all the time because you don't do anything anymore and only go to the gym, and then move to a city with no plan and start a podcast, you're not going to maintain our class status. You're just not going to do it. You have to write for Deadspin.
But Amber, like to your point about childhood, I mean, I know it was the episode we just did before this, but it really reminds me of what Patton said about the anecdote about bicycles and about how the kids in the 70s when it was actually...
Kids just rode random bikes.
Yeah, it was like when it was actually much more dangerous comparatively statistically in this country, kids had a great deal more freedom. And now that we've actually, America is largely safer to a greater degree, but statistically it's probably as safe as it's ever been almost to be alive in America. Kids just, they're not running around. They're not outside because everybody is worried about, you know, the child predators or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. They have to constantly be optimizing
or they have to be like, you know, if they're not in school, they have to be practicing something. Mm-hmm. They have to be like, you know, honing another skill or something so that like, that, you know, 12 years later, they'll look good to college
admissions.
It's changed
the curriculum of school itself. And of course it started out, I think, with these highly competitive, kind of middle class schools. And then they discovered that like, oh, it doesn't work to just grind kids into dust. But where it remains is these underfunded, poor schools where they're like, oh, well, they get 15 minutes to eat. There's no recess. Mm-hmm. Like the half of the shit that people in New York are fighting to get for their kids is literally just recess because there's a point of diminishing returns with little children brains where they cannot pay attention very long.
This back to what I said, like, you know, Arne Duncan is a Democrat in good standing. He was Obama's Secretary of Education, which pushed very hard for, mm-hmm. you know, school privatization, charter schools.
Yeah.
You know, he was extremely anti-teachers unions and anti-public schools in general. Again, I mean, this is not an original point. Many other people have made it, but Obama's kids went to Sidwell Friends. And if you look at the model of learning and this classroom environment in upper class schools like that, it's very affirming and like loose, and you know, there's free time and there's arts and things like that. And I think, again, it's a matter of kind of like class warfare. I think they think that the kids of lower class need to be disciplined more. Mm-hmm. And like the education model needs to be more harsh.
They have to be leaner. They need to be tougher.
To toughen up and like to basically become acclimated to a life of being surveilled, doing mindless tasks, and suppressing their own individuality, basically.
I mean, it's interesting that the sort of professional managerial class vision of childhood, it's called helicopter parenting and derided as kind of a liberal thing, which it is. But the worldview undergirding it is extremely conservative. It reminds me of all those memes you see on, like, you know, pissed off Marines on Facebook that are like, no one's going to give you a handout. Develop a skill. Yeah. You know, every day of your life is a job interview. Everyone's out to get you. The world is dangerous. Start getting ready for job interviews now. It's the exact same worldview underneath both of those things.
You know, it's helicopter parenting for the rich and double tap parenting for the poor. No, it's really, I don't know. It's very depressing and depraved to arrange not just your life, but the lives of your posterity, to arrange your entire legacy around the demands of the market. It's just, I don't know.
Wouldn't you just,
unromantic.
My big thing about it is like, I know these people like love their children on some technical level. But
they're highly valued assets.
Yeah, exactly.
They're members of the team.
Don't you want better for your children? Don't you want them to like have a childhood and maybe find something to do with their lives that they find at least moderately fulfilling? It's fucking nasty out there.
It also makes your kids into neurotics. Could you imagine how fucked up Amy Schwa's kids are by now?
Oh, the Tiger Mom.
Oh, well, they interviewed them actually.
Oh, really?
And one of them is a hyperachiever, and one of them's a fail daughter.
Hell yeah.
And she seems frankly cool. But they're both like, yeah, she was really tough on us, but also she kind of overstated the degree to which she, because you know she was selling books. And then later, she followed up with a weird race science book.
We should
do a reading of.
Now that I got y'all here, check out my race science post. Damn, this blowed up. Just check this
and
out.
Now,
talking about haplogroups.
She has a brand new book.
That's right.
That is about how American politics is tribal, and both sides need to get over their tribal affiliation in order to make America
You're
better.
Literally tribal. You said that Jews and
Mormons.
Asians should have babies so that they could have like big brains and compete on the market.
It is true that she literally wrote a book that said, here are the different distinct racial tribes and the way that they raise their children, making some more successful than others. Hey, America, it's yours fucked up. We're just so tribal.
Would you like to breed an SAT thoroughbred?
What I like,
here are the best matches for your haplogroup.
What I like about Amy Schwa is that all of her theses of her past books lead to the conclusion that her racial group is categorically superior. She wrote this book, World on Fire, where the thesis is that genocides, racial hatred, things like that happen when there is a very competent and successful economically minority in a country where the majority is, you know, more impoverished. And her family were Chinese people in the Philippines, definitely ran through several maids, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And they had to leave the country because I believe their house was burned down.
I'm trying to knock up a bitch from the Merovingian line.
Her husband's Jewish and she's Chinese.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Yeah. That's some genes right there.
And those two are two of the top ones in the scoreboard, too.
Wow. Like, amazing how that works.
What are the odds?
I wonder how many of the purchases of Tiger Mom were from like furry baby fetishists who thought it was about something totally different.
Yeah. That's the good thing about being an Asian race scientist, or no, being a white race scientist, is you could say, it's not just me saying I'm best. I think Asians are better than me. But if you're Asian, it's like, there's nobody you can even like self-effacingly point to. It's like, no,
she's
we're the
juice.
Best.
Matt's right, though. Amy does have a new book out now that's all about how American politics have just gotten so bitterly divided.
Wow.
And she was interviewed by Isaac Chonker.
Chonker.
In Slate this week. And he was like, well, like, what do you mean? Like, it's like, she's like, well, you know, on the right, of course, it's terrible. All the racism and white nationalism. And on the left, things are bad too. And just never elaborates what the corollary is. And of course it's invariably like campus SJW bullshit.
God.
Like, which I'm sorry, like the effects of are, I think are greatly exaggerated.
There is nothing. Yeah, these guys get hooting and hollering about every time five fucking Bard students write a paper about
it's a symptom. I do think it is
in
worth
yoga class.
It is 100% worth looking at the way that universities train up the future ruling class and send them out into the world. But universities are an island. I mean, they're like some of them are just literally just physically, most of them, I would say, like divided from any larger community. I mean, they're made to be like a summer camp. Like that's
well, yeah, it's a consumer experience, and
they're people, not the people, mansion on the
like,
hill.
People look at these guys going hysterical about the illiberal attitudes on college campuses. You really need to stop looking at that through a political lens and just look at all of the lenses of campus agitation as just a bunch of kids going, I need to speak to your manager because they're fucking paying $100,000 for this. They better get what they want.
We commodified the shit out of it so much. And then we're shocked when like, you know, not even so much students, but the parents of these students act like fucking shitty consumers saying this steak is overdone. I want another one.
Yeah. I mean, and also that everything that is supposedly radical and dangerous from a campus just gets subsumed into the larger culture. Like, all the dangerous counterculture bullshit of the 60s. What was the result? It was Steve Jobs saying, oh, when I took LSD, I saw that I could create a new type of phone. Really changing the world. Yeah, wow, this is scary.
My third eye is telling me that America really should learn from China when it comes to environmental and workers' regulations.
The other thought I had when we were talking about, you know, preparing for this interview and just reading up on this strike in West Virginia is, again, back to this issue of healthcare that was being the instigating factor in this strike. And it just, I'm dumbfounded again. What a great country we have.
Woo!
What a great nation that
it's
we live
so
in.
Cool.
Where this is like how
say what you will about how it doesn't cover millions of people and lives are shortened and it's a millstone around the necks of millions of Americans. But at least it's also the most expensive healthcare system in the world.
Felix, I think you said something about this earlier this week where it just, like, as a technique of social control, our health I think that is the point of our health insurance system, in that, like, you pay for health insurance, which is also always way, way too expensive. It's like a huge part of your budget. It winnows down the possibilities for every other thing in your life. And then not only that, you can't you use it, and then you still get hit with a huge bill. And then there are all these tacked on fees, and there's every way to just
they
keep
deny your
claims. You know, employers love to complain about having to provide health care, but man, it is a nice way to discipline a workforce.
Absolutely. Yes. Like, absolutely.
You need this. You might be able to get another job, but what about a gap in coverage?
And the unions are figuring this out because it's always, of course, the first thing on the table to be jiggered with. I think I mentioned earlier, Mark Dudzik, who's the national organizer for labor campaign for single payer, said that, like, look, we need to get this out of the way because it is right now the biggest obstacle to organizing around something like wages, because they keep doing this like bait and switch where they're like, oh, yeah, we'll give you a little raise in cash. It's more money in your pocket. But healthcare becomes less stable, less reliable, less secure. And it just puts you on shakier and shakier ground.
Employer provided insurance is the new company script.
You can't do anything. You can't even quit, you know?
However, Chris, take out when I said script instead of script.
No, we're leaving.
Everyone, no.
You need to see how the sausage gets made.
What do we pay you for except for to take the T sound out? I'm giving you healthcare so I can take it away if you don't do this.
But Felix, the other point you made, though, that I think is important is, like, yeah, this is a great way to just discipline a population and just beat them down into a state of where they disengage from politics because they accurately decide that it really doesn't matter, or the realm of political possibilities offered will have nil effect on their life. However, I think what this strike is showing, and as we said, as we're moving into being a right to work country, maybe you can only push people so. Maybe you can only fuck with people so far.
Yeah, yeah, and that's what. And I mean, when Trump won, everyone saw the writing on the wall with Gorsuch because he's such a, you know, historically anti-union record already going on to a conservative court
and a snack
and fucking sexy.
That's how he wins all those votes. He just flexes.
He was found guilty of being a total hoe.
Yeah.
Well,
Neil deep birth cavity Gorsuch. But like all those great strikes in the 30s, that was when it was illegal to do it. And it's easy for us to say, but you know.
Currently, also, I would say like a huge part of the Corbyn uprising, it has been due to the biggest union called Unite and their strategy, and they are absolutely on their backs. I mean, in some ways, as a direct result of the Labour Party's disengagement from the trade unionist movement. But it's not like there was a huge surge in Labour power that actually even pushed through this campaign. And it's not, I mean, the Labour Party has historically done whatever it wants, sometimes with no input or little to no input from the trade unionist movement. But this didn't happen in a vacuum. A union was a major factor in, you know, Corbyn becoming leader of the Labour Party. And frankly, they're not doing extremely well. They just realized they were in a position of power, as workers are always in some position of power. And they got their shit together. And it's been like incredible. Like the things that you can do, even when the labor movement is in so-called decline, it requires a lot of creativity, and I don't want to like overstate like how easy it could be, but I don't want people to take away from Janice that like it's done, it's over. Like the future is still in labor. It's just not going to look like what you thought it was going to look like.
I mean, you mentioned that obviously we should have these formal legal protections, but like they're obviously, we've had them and they're not a panacea. They're not the answer.
I mean, there are no technical solutions to political problems, and you can't do some sort of like legalistic workaround to actual rank and file trade unionism. It just doesn't work.
All right, guys. Speaking of not knowing what the future would look like, sometimes you don't know what the past would look like. We'll go.
Nice.
I did want to share one bit of behind the scenes. I've been sitting on this one. A little Felix story here. When we were waiting to do the patent interview, Felix walks in, and the first thing he says right off the bat is, real bad news, guys. It looks like Tay-Kay is going to be executed. And for like a half a second, I was like, is he doing his Syria thing or his rap thing? And I was just like...
I'm surprised you haven't been following the Tay-Kay story.
It was the rap thing.
Yes.
Yep.
Tay-Kay did the hit song The Race. Fuck a beat, I'd rather beat a case, but I didn't beat that case. I did The Race. Mm-hmm. And he killed three people for like $100. And then he was on the lam and he did a rap video in front of his unwanted poster. And now they're like, they caught him and it's like, oh yeah, this is probably going to execute him, unfortunately. But
teachers do better.
YBN Namir took his wave. YBN Namir is a great rapper. Folks, don't we love YBN Namir?
Yep.
I think that we could,
that's great.
We could get your two interests together by getting all the imprisoned rappers together, Dirty Dozen style, and sending them to Syria.
Just fix everything. Folks, I can't be the only one that thinks if we got all the rappers together, they could beat all the factions in the Syrian civil war.
Little nugget there. Okay. So to round things out this week, I have a firecracker reading series. Ooh. That came across the transom. It's from February 11th, 2015, which I think is interesting because it makes for an interesting time capsule. However, the Cato Institute chose to bump it again this week.
Love those boys.
That's how I came across it. And it was done under the headline, "What is the greatest libertarian accomplishment of all time?
Bitcoin?
Abolishing slavery."
I was going to say Bitcoin.
Right.
So this is by David Boaz of the Cato Institute. David
Dadaz.
Boaz.
David Moab.
David Moab, yeah. His column is called "Black History is American History." And he's going to attempt to... borrowing from Ryan Cooper here, if you think you have seen valor theft before, this is a whole nother level of valor theft in which he attempts to retcon the history of the abolition of slavery and the Civil War into some grand mission for human liberty and achievement, which is also known as libertarianism.
Yeah, they ad hominem to the slaves to freedom.
So
they went up to Jefferson Davis. They're like, this is a two quack, Mr. Two damn quack. I don't know how it's pronounced. It's Latin.
Two quoque.
Two quoque?
Quoque.
Yeah, whatever.
Two quavo.
So here we go. David Boaz. Some people think libertarians care only about taxes and regulations.
We also like weed, dude.
But I was asked not long ago, what's the most important libertarian accomplishment in history?
Lowering age of consent laws.
Somalia.
I said, the abolition of slavery. The greatest libertarian crusade in history was the effort to abolish chattel slavery, culminating in the 19th century abolitionist movement and the heroic Underground Railroad. It's no accident
they charged them to get on that Underground Railroad.
They privatized the Underground Railroad.
It was a private rail network.
Yeah, the Underground Railroad got together when they were all found arguing in the comment section of an abolitionist newspaper about cannon in Uncle Tom's cabin.
It's no accident that abolitionism emerged out of the ferment of the Industrial Revolution and the American Revolution. So essentially what he's going to do here is claim that the classical liberals of the 19th century who were most in favor of free markets were also abolitionists. Henceforth, abolishing slavery was a libertarian goal, which to me is sort of similar to people like people who say shit like Jesus Christ. He was a socialist. You know, if you read the Bible,
that's a good one.
Yeah,
that's a good one when you get people with that.
Like, I really don't think it makes much sense to read, sort of graft onto like modern political movements and beliefs onto people in history, even going back more than like 20 or 30 years.
They call it reading incoherent. Resistance.
Yeah, it becomes completely incoherent.
This is like the Freud quote where he said, there is little difference between the philosopher and the schizophrenic both believe there to be a conspiracy in the text.
Zoroaster was a Reagan Democrat.
Hammurabi was a mother bitching Hillary voter. He had a code.
George Washington did smoke weed, though, for real. Check out his diaries, folks. He cultivated that hemp.
He held them between the teeth that he got from slaves.
Wait, so
April 3rd. 1782. I am in a general store. I see a man buy a moldy old banana. Wait, what procedure did you get?
Wait, so is Game Master Anthony a schizophrenic or a philosopher?
Both.
By the way, happy birthday, Game Master Anthony.
Oh, yeah. Happy. He's 41 now, is he?
43, I believe.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
He's getting up there.
Did he finally have the birthday party he's been wishing for, though?
I don't know.
That's what Trump meant when he said we're going to win again.
You know what he did, though? He did it in VR chat.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Folks, all the great characters, Knuckles, Tails, even Dark Sonic, okay? Look, they're all going to be there for Anthony's birthday party. Do we love Anthony? Do we love the party that Anthony's going to have when Goku helps him blow out the candles, okay?
It's like
Samus is going to be there when you get 100% completion. Oh, my God, her body, folks. And she's going to be there. And I think Game Master Anthony is going to have a little birthday surprise, okay? Anthony, do you think you can handle all that? Okay, yes, folks, he can.
I think it's he never actually has the party. It's like Passover, or it's next year in Jerusalem.
Next year, with all the...
And they leave a chair open for Sonic.
Yeah, they leave a little Mountain Dew for him, yeah.
Game Master Anthony kicks ass.
He's great.
He's better than anyone on my timeline.
If you're listening, you know, give us a shout out.
Well, we're giving you a shout out. Just contact us.
Well, give us a shout out with that message.
back to David Boaz. He says here, how could Americans proclaim that all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, without noticing that they themselves were holding other men and women in bondage? They could not, of course. The ideas of the American Revolution, individualism, natural rights, and free markets led logically to agitation for the extension of civil and political rights to those who had been excluded from liberty as they were from power, notably slaves, serfs, and women. Okay. The problem here is that David, in his sort of history of Enlightenment thinking and natural rights and individual freedom and whatnot is reading against the actual libertarian tradition of property rights. And as if, whether he's talking about the abolition of slavery or the abolition of serfs, he's skipping over how those were actually accomplished in the real world, which cuts 100% against everything libertarians claim to believe in.
Well, and you know, you don't even have to guess that. They say it. Ron Paul famously complains that Lincoln could have freed the slaves by buying them all, which is which is fundamentally incorrect. We know that for a fact. There were attempts made. The most interesting one is that at the end, towards the end of the war, there was an attempt to do compensated manumission in Delaware, which was a slave state that never left the Union. And this would have been, we're going to pay them the small number. There weren't a lot of slaveholders in Delaware, but the small number of slave owners, we're going to pay them to free their slaves. This was in a state that was in the Union at a time when the war was winding down and everyone could see that the South is going to lose. And they still, in Delaware,
rejected
it.
They still literally
said no.
Thank you, no, we would prefer the slaves.
They still said no. So you're telling me that in 1861, you're going to be able to say, hey, you know your whole social political system that you have invested generations in justifying morally and intellectually and in this entire basis of your social order, we'll cut you a check. It's gibberish. It doesn't make sense. What defeated slavery was the power of the big bad state. And you know how it was funded? The first issuance in America of fiat currency.
Ah!
The fucking bugbear of libertarians was to fund the Civil War. That was the first fiat currency. Well, okay. Greenbacks, they were called.
I hear what you're saying, but what if Lincoln had tried to compensate them with blockchain currency?
You hew wood, and this creates the blockchain.
It's blocks of wood.
It's literal masonry.
Oh, I imagine back then you just got a bunch of Keebler elves to grind together some gears, and that was your little Bitcoin mining operation. Very cute.
Well, you get a whole bunch of Bartlebys to write out the ledger that you just tell him whatever the transaction is.
We should do
nation's economy collapses because he would prefer not to do it. I'm skipping ahead here, but David writes, in the United States, the abolitionist movement was naturally led by libertarians. they called themselves abolitionists, but again, like when
it wasn't an identity at that point.
When did libertarian become like an actual?
It
like,
didn't get a large
identity?
L until the 60s, I would say.
It's a product 60s. Of Ayn Rand, the latter half of the 20th century.
Ayn Rand and the whole business roundtable reaction to the New Deal, which cut checks to every fucking half baked intellectual in the country in order to create an intellectual infrastructure to oppose popular Keynesianism.
I think he's trying to identify with that like Thoreau tradition, right?
Yeah.
But Thoreau was a flake, too.
Most of these
flake.
Guys were flakes. I mean, God bless them. But, yeah.
He wrote a great nature documentary, but he was not an amazing, like, political thinker.
And the whole time his mom was doing his laundry.
Yeah, his mom was doing his laundry, bringing him pies and cookies. He was a failed son.
Well, every great, every, like, pivotal thinker was kind of a failed son. I mean, I've already touched on it, but Martin Luther was a shit poster.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
True. He bigoted posts while he was in the bathroom. He was a literal shit.
Yeah, his wife had to remind him to like change his clothes and shit and empty out his piss bucket. And he was a fat, bigoted guy with a bowl cut.
Leading abolitionists called slavery man stealing in that it sought to deny self-owner.
Wait.
They called themselves Mr. Steal Your Man.
This. I have never heard this. I feel like, Matt?
I've heard the phrase. The idea that
this
it was
is
a,
not
common
a common
parlance.
I'm
sick of getting on the subway and I see someone man-stealing.
They called it man-stealing in that it sought to deny self-ownership and a steal every man's a man's very self. Their arguments paralleled those of John Locke and the libertarian agitators known as the Levelers. William Lloyd Garrison wrote that his goal was not just the abolition of slavery, but the emancipation of our whole race from the dominion of man, from the thraldom of self, from the government of brute force.
I'm still getting my head around him calling the Levelers libertarians.
Who are the Levelers?
They were a group of
speedrunners,
British Civil War veterans who came together to demand the end of aristocratic privilege, but also redistribution of land and incomes after the English Civil War. The Putney debates were their sort of high point of militancy and influence.
Sounds pretty libertarian to me.
Yeah.
Frederick Douglass likewise made his arguments for abolition in the terms of classical liberalism and libertarianism, self-ownership and natural rights.
Mm.
After the Civil War, he continued his fight for equal freedom, campaigning against Southern states' efforts to avoid following the new constitutional amendments. David, is this really libertarianism?
Well, it's one of those things where they're just taking one strand of libertarian thought and saying that it connects to these previous thinkers to the point that you can call them the same thing. There's no way to throw that back, to retroactively justify your reasoning that way. It's just a way to sort of find one time that people with one strand of your beliefs had in common actually did something for somebody else.
He goes on here to say racism is a problem and then quotes Ayn Rand to make the case for why it's illogical.
No, I get it now. It's a probability brooch opened up from Ayn Rand's time to the middle of the 19th century, where she sent back copies of The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged for these early libertarians to find and decipher, kind of like Joseph Smith did,
yeah.
And they became abolitionists.
Yeah. If you collect all the pieces of The Fountainhead, you can rise up and become the anarchy ball.
Ayn Rand, who famously said that white people were justified in massacring the people who lived in North America because, hey, what were they doing? Did they have any railroads? No, they deserve to die. So, yeah, well done there.
Just finishing up here, he says, the struggle for freedom is never finished. Today, libertarians work for economic freedom that would mean more growth and more jobs, for the freedom of all families to choose better schools for their children, a callback to earlier in this episode, for the end to the counterproductive war on drugs. That's their little nugget in there to just be like, hey, we're not complete monsters.
For the end to the unjust war on selling infants.
And for criminal justice reform. Respect for the dignity of each person is the foundation of moral and social progress.
Okay.
Which I believe in. However, I found interesting about this reading series is what an interesting time capsule it makes from just 2 years ago, 3 years ago now, in that pretty much everyone, like the libertarian moment is pretty much over as far as I can
see.
Yeah,
they're all Nazis.
Yeah.
And what are they, everyone who at least online identified as a libertarian is now overwhelmingly just alt-right.
Yeah. Yes,
like or regular right,
or just regular right.
To the degree that there's a distinction, they're like seeping. They went from libertarian to pretty blatant Nazi, and now the Nazi is just eating the rest of the.
And as people who have studied this should have found out. I mean, the libertarian is pretty much the gateway drug into the harder stuff almost
absolutely.
All the time.
Yeah.
But what I found interesting is just 3 years ago, the Cato Institute and the main intellectual organ for the libertarian movement, and I'm using quotes around movement.
He's using quotes, folks.
is the effort that they had to sell it in the terms of that we are the heir to the civil rights movement or the abolition of slavery.
Yeah.
When, again, if you were to make a Venn diagram, I forget who said this, but he was like, if you made a Venn diagram of everyone who says that the Civil War didn't have to be fought or Lincoln could have just bought the slaves, and people who identify as libertarian, it would be a circle. It's just like that.
Yeah.
Well, if you want to move past actually owning people, if you want to go into Jim Crow era, if you want to go into lunch counter shit, all of the defenses of segregation that people still kind of make, to be honest, whatever, gay cakes and all that, is like the, you have the right to refuse service to anyone you want to refuse service to.
That's what Rand Paul said. Rand Paul, who's currently in the Senate, he's not some fucking Dixiecrat, said that the Civil Rights Act of 1964, he would not have supported it because it would have compelled these private people, because that's the thing. If your rights are limited by the degree to which you hold property, people without property essentially become totally rightless because they cannot exercise any sort of autonomy in the world because they don't have property. And he might say owning a person is bad, but what if you're in a future situation where all of your libertarian policy proposals have gone through and it's created this catastrophic gulf between the property and then the unproperty, and things are so bad for those who don't have access to resources that they say, hey, I'll let you buy me. Now, that's somebody consenting to become property.
Hell yeah.
That seems to me, for those guys who are saying that these are universal human rights beliefs that extend to every human being, I think it would give them pause. I mean, we know for a fact that Rothbard said you should be able to sell your children.
No, I gotta say, this is just 100% unadulterated statism right there. slavery's been by constitutional amendments. I don't need a constitutional amendment to defend my rights. And if I want to enter into a contract where I sell myself as a slave for the rest of my life, I have a right to do that.
Yeah, but that's the big thing.
This is cuck shit.
Is that using fiat currency to create a million man conscripted army to march into another country and burn down their private property? That is not a libertarian solution to anything. So libertarianism cannot, in any plausible sense, be said to be directly contributing to the end of slavery.
A force of liberation, let's say.
Lincoln was a pragmatic libertarian. I mean, who's to say that, like, the Dutch East India Company couldn't have wiped out slavery much earlier?
Yeah. Like Blackwater.
Yeah, exactly.
Contracted out.
Okay, that does it for this week's show. Quick plug. Are we still watching the Oscars this Sunday?
Yes, we
are. Let's do it.
I want
to
do it.
I only have time to watch one of the shitty movies in this year. Can you guys tell me which one to...
I'd say the one that would annoy you the most would be maybe Lady Bird or Call Me By Your Name.
You should watch Lady Bird, actually.
I thought Lady Bird was good. The one that will annoy you the most is The Shape of Water.
Really? You think the fish fucking thing will annoy you?
I'm curious what Felix would think of Lady Bird.
It is a little... It's a little...
It's fanciful.
Soft-hearted. It's very... Yeah, it's a modern fairy tale. Well,
Guillermo del Toro is a friend of Hideo Kojima.
That's the thing, is that I think he would like it because the creature looks like something out of one of his video games.
Well, I don't usually play the fantasy video games. I like a hardcore military simulator, and then a mil sim light, and then a stealth tactical experience and a tactical shooter. I enjoy some adventure games.
The point is, I don't think he's adverse to fantasy.
Actually, it's not something he'd find in one of his video games. It's something you'd find under his couch.
Actually, it's still clean.
Yeah, you should see under my couch
right now.
We're
really proud of you.
Thank you. I told you I would do it.
No, we're big film buffs here on Chapo, as I'm sure you know. We're going to watch the Oscars this Sunday. Watch along with us. We'll be periscoping it.
Oh, yeah. Just before we go, my top picks for the Oscar this year, Payback, 1998. Sicario, 2015. And... let's say Collateral, Tom Cruise, 2004.
Oh, another quick plug. We're coming to the West Coast, and every date is sold out except for Portland. There's a few tickets left at the Holocene. Go to chapotraphouse.com to buy one. Just exactly one. And also buy the book.
Absolutely, buy the book. And look forward to seeing you guys on the West Coast at all sold out shows.
Woo!
Until next time, guys.
No eye contact on the West Coast. Goodbye.
Bye.